This is Hannah Schumann. I'm a social work intern at the Actors Fund, and we're here on March 12th, 2018. I'm interviewing Barbara Kahn, who's an actor, playwright, and director in New York City. So tell me a little bit about your family, your childhood, and how you became interested in this profession.
Well, I come from a family of immigrants, and my father was a refugee, which I always make that distinction. He was a child in a war zone, and my grandmother was stranded with her children in Eastern Europe in the middle of a war, with my grandfather already in this country and not able to reach his family. And my grandmother, in the midst of that war, it took 4 years raising money, with her children being sometimes shot at and fortunately missed, to raise enough money to pay smugglers to get them out of there, which is why Mother Courage is my favorite play.
Wow.
I grew up in a town near Philadelphia, and I can't remember not wanting to work in theater, so I don't know where that came from. It certainly didn't come from my family. We have no legacy of performing artists in my background. But I always wanted to do that, and I don't know where it came from. But I knew at a certain point, probably before I was five, that I better keep it to myself, which I did. Until I was about 8 years old, and then I gathered the family and told them what I was going to do with my life, and realized I better wait another few years to keep that discussion going. In the meantime, the local library, which was very small, actually had a very good theater history division, but I was too young to access it. It was in the adult section. So I borrowed my older sister's library card and managed to get those books, and I'm sure the librarian knew that I was not my sister, but never said anything, I think, because there was nothing inappropriate about those books. But I read everything I could get my hands on about theater history, the bios, the autobiographies, and I was just enthralled. And I could not wait to be part of that collection of wonderful, wonderful people. But eventually I used up the books that were there, and I was able to go into Philadelphia by myself. And the Philadelphia Library had a huge collection about theater in Philadelphia, going back to the grandmother of the Barrymore family, Louisa Lane. And I read all of that, and I started exploring Philadelphia, trying to find the buildings, the theaters, which, of course, were long gone. And if you jump to junior high, which in New York everybody calls middle school, and I took a class in public speaking, and we had to do reports for the class with visual arts. So the other students did, I guess, it was typical for young teenagers to report on about their family life or the books they liked or whatever. My first one was on the Barrymore family, with highlights, with graphic charts and things about the family tree and everything, which I noticed as I was doing it, I was totally boring the class, and I didn't care because I was having fun. My next one was on the beginnings of the star system in Hollywood, going back to silent movies. Well, at a certain point, the teacher called me over after class, and she told me that Temple University had a summer theater program for high school students, but she thought she could get me in. So it was a bit of a struggle with my parents, and I think they finally thought if they let me do it, I would say it was probably hard work and I'd get it out of my system. But to this day, it is the most exciting, wonderful summer I've ever had in my life. So that takes me up to probably what your next question is.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So what were some of your first jobs in the industry, or some of your first roles that you remember clearly?
Well, I always knew what I wanted to do, which was get out of where I was and get myself to New York, but I was too young, and I didn't know what to do in the meantime. And I saw a very small notice in the Philadelphia newspaper about they were casting actors all ages for a new film to be shot in Philadelphia. And it had the date and the address. And I went there. No headshot, no resume, nothing. And I filled out the application form. And it was my turn to be called in for the interview when there were maybe 3 or 4 people sitting behind a desk. They spoke to me very, very reasonably, very professionally, but told me there was nothing in the movie for me. But I walked out and I was on cloud nine because I felt like I was an actor. You know, I felt no condescension from these people. So that lasted for quite a while. And the following summer, my mother came to get me and said, "You have a phone call." And it was the director from that film. And he said, "I didn't have anything for you in that." And he said, "But I'm casting a theater festival, and I need somebody to help me at auditions. Would you want to do that? You know, you could call the people who were up next. And then if there was nobody to read with them, you could read opposite them." And I spent 3 glorious days doing that. And in between, when there was nobody who showed up or was scheduled, we talked. And he talked about acting. And it was wonderful. And it cut to about a year later. I was already in high school, in actually my last year of high school. And he contacted me and said that he was starting a free workshop for professional actors, and I was welcome to join. It was every Monday night in this settlement house in North Philadelphia, free, from 7 to midnight. And I was probably the only kid. You know, they were all like working actors in Philadelphia. And it was amazing. But it meant my father, on his only day off, had to drive me into Philadelphia and wait. And he did, you know. I mean, I got lots of mixed messages from my parents about my career choice. And I learned, and this was Bob Sickinger, and I learned from him so much about what it meant to be a professional, how to comport myself on stage, you know, the responsibility to the other cast members, all that kind of stuff besides the actual skills. And combining that with what I learned that summer at Temple, which was very technical training. And with Bob, it was very Stella Adler, Strasberg-based. Lots of organic exercises, whether it was sensory work or emotional recall, all of that. It gave me a really good basis. Now, a lot of that stuff I didn't understand, but I did it because I was 16, 17 years old. But later on in New York, when I was working professionally, I would get a job and I would think, oh, that's what that means. I can use that right there. So it all kind of fell in. I didn't forget anything that he taught. And it was just a wonderful introduction to, you know, what was ahead of me. And he did tell me, though, one time when I was monitoring the auditions for him, and there was a break, and I saw the film script on a chair, and I reached for it, and he said, "Don't touch that." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because I'll go to jail if you do." And he explained to me that he made the film, which obviously was a pornographic movie, to make the money so he could do his theater work. And I said, okay, but I was so curious. But I never did get to read it. And, you know, he was just such a wonderful human being. He eventually moved on to Chicago to run the theater at Hull House. And then later on, years later, he was back in New York City, and we got back in touch. He came to see the production of a play that I wrote, and I was thrilled. It meant so much, you know, because we went so far back, and he was so influential in my career. And I still reference things I learned from him. And I try, when I coach actors, to share that information as well.
Yeah. Did you have any other important mentors in your life that you feel like kind of molded the actor that you are today?
Well, I've had a long career, so yes, there were quite a few. when I actually came to New York and I was going to college to get a degree in theater at Adelphi, and I squeezed full-time credits into 3 days so I could do theater in the city. I was out on Long Island, and I started working off Broadway, and I worked nonstop. I was in a play rehearsing for the next one, and there were just a number of people that were very influential in my life. The playwright Tom Ion, I did a few of his plays. The director Ron Link, who became a dear friend, and we actually lived together briefly because he told me he was in between apartments and he needed a place for a week, which was, he actually meant he didn't have a place and he stayed in my apartment for 6 months. But I just loved being directed by him. You know, he was so gentle and yet very sure of what he wanted to do with the piece. Another one was playwright Ted Harris, who also became a good friend. Ted, I did a play of his called Gabriella, and I was actually the offstage voice, which was supposed to be the soundtrack of an old movie. And somebody came up to him after a performance and said to him, "What movie is that from? I don't recognize it, and I'm a big movie buff." So he called me over and he said, "This is the old movie." And then I heard somebody say to him, and the play was about a has-been movie star who was arrested for shoplifting. And about a week before we opened, a movie star was arrested for shoplifting. And somebody came up to Ted after a performance and said, "Was that play about so-and-so?" Oh, no, he said to him, "That play was about so-and-so, wasn't it?" And Ted said, "Yeah." And I gave him the look like, we've been rehearsing for 3 weeks. And afterwards, I said to him, "Why did you say that?" And he said something that has stayed to me to this day as a playwright. He said, "If somebody comes up to you and tells you what your play is about, never contradict them. They will be so proud of themselves and their tremendous insight. If you correct them, they will be embarrassed and they'll never come to see your work again." So that has stayed with me, and I share that when I coach playwrights, you know. Because you can't tell somebody that they felt or they learned something that they didn't. You know, it's valid if that's what they took away from your play, and I think that's what Teddy meant when he said that. So that's always stayed with me. As far as other influences and mentors, Marilyn Roberts was on the bill in one of the first plays I was in New York City, and we've remained close friends for many, many years, and I was just in awe of her talent, and occasionally, if I was having trouble with a role, I would go to her for help, and she always helped, and she's just one of the most generous people that I've met in the profession. I'm trying to think of who, Robert Dada, the director. Bob was so influential. He took me over to Crystal Field at Theater for the New City to tell Crystal she should put me on this committee for a festival they were organizing, that I was a brilliant playwright. And before I left my house, something told me, "Stick a script in your bag." And afterwards, Crystal came up to me and said, "So you're a playwright? Give me a play." And I said, "Okay, here." And she was shocked. But at the next meeting, she said, "I read the first 3 pages of your play. They're wonderful. I can't wait to read the rest." And, of course, she never read the rest. But it took about a year and a half of volunteering there in other capacities as well and asking her constantly, "When are you going to do my play?" And finally she called me up and said, "I have a spot for your play." That was 1994, and I've been doing a new play annually there since then. Wow. Which is just a treasure for a playwright. And Crystal said to me, after like the second or third production, she said, "You'll see, as you have a new play each year and you have another production, you'll learn from it and you'll see your work evolve." And she said, "That only happens when you're able to do that." And she's right. I mean, I feel not just myself and how I know about my work, but the responses that I've gotten and the fact that my work, even though it's based there, has been done all over the country. It's been done in Europe, But I owe that to, you know, my base at Theater for the New City. So my very first play, however, I co-authored it with Ray Hagen, and we had been doing plays at La Mama under Ellen Stewart as actors, and we wrote this play together. We took 3 months to write it, but it was all in longhand, and when we typed it up, it was 11 pages. But we wrote parts for our friends, and then we forgot about it, and somebody called Ray, I don't know how they got a copy of it, and said, I'm a director, I want to direct your play, but it should be a musical. So Ray knew this couple, they were teenagers, who wrote words and music, and they wrote the music to the play. And then we went into production with this director, playing the parts we wrote for ourselves, which is why we wrote it in the first place, and for our friends. And we had a big falling out with this man. He wanted to turn it into something that it wasn't. It was a piece of fluff. You know, honestly, it was fun. It was entertaining. But there was no other message to it. And he kept trying to bring all this dark stuff into it, and we would argue. And finally, he probably claims he quit, but we parted ways. So there we were with the production and no place for it to live. So Ray called Ellen Stewart, since we had done plays there and she knew us, and she gave us a slot. So my very first play was produced at Cafe La Mama by Ellen Stewart. And for 12 performances, every night she would get up there and she'd ring her bell and she'd say, "Welcome to La Mama, dedicated to the playwright and all aspects of the theater." And I will never forget that introduction.
That's such a nice story. Yeah.
And so then I moved on from there to Theater for the New City, where I'm still doing work.
Okay. I think that a lot of young people feel or struggle with feeling successful in the industry. Do you feel like there was a turning point for you where you felt like you made it, quote-unquote, or is that kind of a lifelong process?
Well, as somebody whose work has primarily been in not-for-profit theater, also known as downtown theater, also known as off-Broadway, we measure success in a different way than other people, with a different ruler. And it's not how much money you've made. It's not how famous you are in mainstream. It's, are you getting your artistic vision realized? And to that I can answer yes. So if that's success, do I struggle financially? Of course, we all do who work downtown. But, you know, what's the most important thing is not how much money we make. Because if that were the case, I'd be an advertising executive by now, you know, moving up from one of the day jobs that I had. And that's not what I wanted. So I certainly had those opportunities to, you know, to have a financially successful career. But the people that I would notice when I go in these day jobs who'd had those positions, you know, all had ulcers or they were nasty, or, you know, or they were very, very sad. And that scared the hell out of me. I said, that's never going to be me. So even though I struggle, you know, financially, I don't struggle artistically. And that's the most important thing. Some years ago, somebody gave me the phone number of a high school friend that I had lost touch with after high school, so it was decades ago. And I called her. And we had been pretty good friends, but in school, not socially. And instead of asking me, "What have you done with your life?" she said, "Did you ever get to do what you wanted to do with your life?" And that phrasing startled me, and I thought for a second, and I realized I could answer yes. And that was a turning point for me in realizing that I didn't have to measure myself against what anybody else was doing, you know, what awards maybe they got. Some of them didn't get the same awards I got, so what? You know? The primary answer was, yes, I've got to do what I wanted to do with my life.
So what do you think it's important for actors to study or train in between roles, mm-hmm. or in general at all?
Absolutely. And when I used to have more time to watch TV at night, and I would see these celebrities on a talk show, or there was Johnny Carson or Jay Leno, bragging about how they never took an acting lesson, when in fact I knew who they studied with. And I never understood why so many of them felt that lessened them to admit to that. I mean, you wouldn't get a surgeon saying, oh, I never went to medical school. You know, and it's, of course, the significance of it is very different, but I don't know why anybody would be ashamed that they of studying and be proud. And some of that's changing. I noticed, like at the Academy Awards, somebody will thank a teacher. And I wish that over the years more of them had done that, because these people are important in our lives. And aside from the experiences that I had, them very formal, I also, in New York, once I got out of college and I had my bachelor's degree in theater arts, which I've never needed to display anywhere or show, but made my father happy that his daughter finished college. Anyway, I went to a professional workshop, which was run by Arthur Storch. And again, it was once a week, and it was scene study. And we learned the skills that we needed. And I loved how he taught. He never let us talk about our personal lives. If he said, how did you work on that? And somebody started saying, well, I substituted this terrible experience I had with mother. And he said, I don't want to know about you and your mother. I want to know how you've used that substitution. He said, we're talking about technique here and about skills. This is not therapy. And so many teachers, or some teachers, don't follow that. And they really kind of get into their students' heads and their backgrounds, and they're not qualified to do that. You know, I come from a family of social workers, so I know the difference. And Arthur never did that. He was very, very clear, but he was tough. At one point, he said to me, after I just finished a scene, and we were on a break, and he said, three strikes and you're out. And I thought, what does he mean? What did I do, you know? And I called him at home, and I said, did I do something? Did I offend you? What are you talking about? And I said, why did you say that to me? And he said, because I noticed you're settling. And he said, I'd already started to write plays. And he said, I know that you have an imagination, and I want you to use it. And I said, okay, go for it. I said, as long as I know that it's not something personal, or, you know, I said, fine, criticize me all you want, you know. And he did. But it was always, other than that comment on the side, it was always in front of the class. It was always professional, and I loved how he taught. He would ask us what we were working on, so he never talked about what we weren't working on, because he said, what's the point if you haven't, you know, if you weren't trying that, what is there to discuss? So just tell us what you're working on and how you're using it. And then it's up to us to tell you if we felt you succeeded or not. And then if not, what in the technique, or maybe in a different technique, can you use to get to the same goal? And that was so useful. And I stayed in Arthur's class off and on for over 5 years. You know, I would stop if I was in a production and I just didn't have time. But I always came back until he left for Syracuse and started the university theater department there and the theater. But no, he was a very, very valuable part of my training. I also went to coaches if I was on a particular in a particular play and I was having trouble with a character. I would go to, if my friend, mentor, Marilyn Roberts, was not available, I would go to a coach, and I went to two wonderful coaches that taught me a lot, and we had the luxury of working one-to-one as opposed to the classroom. which is what I do now with actors and playwrights, is working one-to-one. I don't teach classes. But the first one that I went to was Sandra Seacat, who since moved to Hollywood and is coaching all these, you know, movie stars, very successfully, I might add. And I worked with her for close to 2 years, once a week. And she just, she would devote so much time to just one moment in a monologue. And we would work for months on that. And it just, it was so valuable. We would explore all the different ways. How did it, you know, what was I using that I could relate to that? And I remember one of them was, it was a monologue based on a material by Colette. And the first line was, and she's home alone, and the first line is, I don't have to examine that noise. There's no one else here. So we worked on being alone when you know that nobody's there and you hear a noise that you shouldn't be hearing. And we worked for months on that and all the different ways to approach it and everything. And from that, I gained the, you know, the knowledge that I could then transfer to other moments and other plays that I was in and not have to take so long. You know, because once you learn these techniques, they're rehearsal techniques, they're not performance techniques. And you work on them privately, and then after a while you learn that the shortcuts are there. You know, if I work on a long private moment, then maybe when I'm in the play where I'm trying to use that, when I get to that moment, maybe I just need to think of the color red, because that was part of that whole experience, and everything comes up, all the emotional life is there. So there are a lot of things that I learned from the teachers and the coaches. The other coach who I adored was Roz Valero. I'm not sure what happened to her. I know she moved to California, and then we lost touch. And she taught me something so significant. And it was, at the time that we were working together, she was in a production of Ivanov by Chekhov. And the character was a woman who gave up her family to marry this man. She was disowned. 20 years later, he meets somebody else, and he's telling her they're finished. And she has nowhere to go, nothing to rely on, no support system. And Roz came in one day, she's saying, I'm having so much trouble. She said, I can't stand this actor I'm working with. He's giving me nothing. I don't know what to give, and I don't know what to do. The next time we met, she said, I figured it out. And she said, I was working on losing something, and I didn't know what it was. I knew what it was on the page, but I didn't really know what it was. So she said, instead of working on that moment, I wrote a whole description for myself of our wedding night. Where it was, who was there, was it outside, inside, what the food was, what feelings I had about what was ahead of me with this man I adored. And she said, I took as much time and I wrote it as long as I could possibly make it. And then I put it away, and at the next rehearsal when I got to that scene, I knew what I lost and it was there. And that was such a valuable skill. And I share it when I direct my productions. I'll suggest it to actors, even though I'm not supposed to be teaching acting. But, you know, there's no reason not to share that. You know, and I tell them, you don't have to tell me or the co-director or anybody else. But, you know, it might be a good idea for you to create this before this particular scene that you're in. So you have a sense of where you're coming from, that the play, the scene doesn't begin when the lights come up on that scene. You know, so I learned that from Roz.
Yeah. What kinds of things do you do besides your training to prepare for a role or for your creative process? Says.
Well, I try to get more sleep than I usually get. And, well, I have two one-woman plays that I wrote for myself that I do whenever I have the opportunity, and I've been doing them off and on, you know, usually one shot since the late 90s. And since there are these big gaps in time, it's important for me to keep the work fresh. So one of the things that I know as an acting teacher or coach is don't try to recreate that moment, you know, that the audience clapped. Now, do the same basic work and let it happen. And I share that with actors too, is stop making it happen. Do your homework and then let it happen. And there's a big difference in that with the performance that looks I hate to say theatrical, it's a bad word, but, you know, too dramatic when it's inappropriate, or too practiced. It doesn't look spontaneous, and performances should always look spontaneous. So whenever I schedule one of these plays, I have to go back and I look at my notes that I made for the private work, and I try to see, is that still a good substitution? You know, it's years later that since I've done it, should I maybe try something else? And I do that work at home or with a director to try to keep it fresh. So the basic work is the same. The character's the same. The script is the same. You know, but I have to be careful not to just repeat it, to just, you know, reiterate the same performance, to recreate the original work. And that's what I think keeps it fresh. So that's one of the things I'm very aware of. I also was in a two-character play, short play, that I did off and on for 2.5 years. And it was about a 30-minute play. And at the end of that 2.5 years, I still felt that there were parts of the character I hadn't yet explored. And that was a really good experience. Because people say, how could you be in a long run? Oh, my God, that'd be awful. No, it wasn't. I could have gone on forever, except that there were other factors involved with stopping doing it. You know, so all of these experiences, I had such wonderful mentors and teachers, and I try to share that with students or with the actors that I'm directing.
What do you think, besides financially, which you touched on, what have been some of the biggest challenges as a professional in the entertainment industry?
Well, as somebody who, as I said, my work has primarily been, at least in New York City, in off Broadway or, you know, downtown theater or not-for-profit theater, there's always been a big divide, which I find really unfortunate, between those of us who do that and the ones who work in commercial theater. You know, we're not community theater, and there's nothing wrong with community theater, but we're not community theater, we're professional theater. You know, but we're not for profit. And there's a big divide and a conflict between the two groups, and it's especially apparent in the acting unions. And I noticed that those of us trying to get updates to the, for instance, to the showcase code, it was almost impossible. It took years and years and years to get that updated. Why? Because the people on council didn't come from the theater that we're working in, you know, and so it was not a priority for them, or they didn't give it the same credibility. I mean, I'm guessing they're, you know, what's behind it, but that's the only explanation I can think of. And, you know, I'm a proud union member, you know, of both acting unions. And, I mean, I find that less so in Screen Actors Guild, because the filmmaking is something different. But again, you have the background actors versus the others. And I noticed the difference when I had speaking roles in films, and how you're treated on the set, usually. I mean, they're usually nice to everybody, but there's a whole different thing. We need you in wardrobe. Here's your, you know, this is your makeup person. I mean, just the whole manner of approach to somebody is very different and probably unintentional. But I've, like I say, less so than in Actors Equity, which I've had some difficulty with, particularly in recent years. Maybe I shouldn't get into that, but for a long time it was impossible. They never updated the showcase code for improvements in technology. So we were not allowed to record anything unless it was for Lincoln Center Archives, which was not very likely for off Broadway at that time. And there was a production of my play some years ago, and I got the people to come from New York One on stage. And they came to see it, and they said, "We're coming back with a video crew." And I could not let them do that. Now, that was a long time ago. Since then, have I ever been able to get them to come back? No way. Even though I put on the press release, videotaping is now permitted. You know, once you lose that opportunity, it's usually lost. So it was that kind of thing. I've written book and lyrics for several musicals, and we wanted to do studio recordings. If we had equity members, we would not have been able to do that without paying them what the commercial rate would be, which we had no budget for. But nobody was being exploited, so there were no exceptions made. There was no nuance to these rules. You know, we were not exploiting anybody. The actors that performed, they got studio original cast recordings of off Broadway musicals. That was unheard of, and they got that. And they used that to move on to, you know, different careers. You know, one of the women, I gave her first role in New York City in a musical called Pirates, the Courtship Chronicles. And she so far has won 2 Emmy Awards, a SAG Award, you know. So who was exploited? You know, and the same thing with some other people who maybe didn't get Emmy Awards yet, but, you know, have gone on to have significant commercial careers. So the fact that there was no way to budge them on that for a long, long time was very disheartening for somebody like me who's so pro-union and not exploitive of the actors I'm working with. I mean, I would never be that way because I identify with them more so than with anybody else involved in the production.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So a little bit change of topic, but as someone who has gone down a couple different paths within this industry, what kind of advice would you give to someone who is looking to transition either from being an actor to a director or to a playwright?
Well, I could tell you why I started writing plays. As I said before, when I came to New York, I was working off Broadway. I was in one play rehearsing for the next, and it went on for a couple of years. And one day I realized I had nothing scheduled. I had just finished a show, and I had nothing coming up, and I was terrified. And I mentioned this on other occasions. I didn't know. I mean, I thought about it, and I thought, well, I've been in some really bad plays, and I've been in some excellent plays. So if I write something for myself, I know it's not going to be as bad as the worst plays. It may not be as good as the best plays, but they all got produced. So why can't I do that? And that's how I started writing a play for myself. The problem was by the time it got produced, I was too old to play the character that I wrote for myself. So I ended up directing it. But that's how I kind of shifted into playwriting. And then at one point, I finished the draft of a play, and I realized there was no role for me. And I said, well, I guess you're a playwright. And directing, I came into in a different way. A friend at the time was producing an evening of plays that had been adapted, and she was in all of the plays, and that was the whole point. And the director left, and she called me up. It was 3 a.m, I remember, because she knew I would be up. And she said, you have to take over and direct it. otherwise we have to close, and I don't want to do that. We have, you know, you have 2 weeks. And I said, I've only directed in college. I have never directed professionally. She said, well, you could do it. And I did. And from that, I got offers of other directing jobs for other people's work. And for a long time, I directed the plays of other playwrights until I got involved with Theater for the New City. And I've been on this loop of having a new production, a new play of mine every year. So I really don't have the time or the energy to direct to somebody else's plays, you know. So, but I love doing that. It got me to London. It got me, you know, to other locations. And so as far as advice I would give, I find it really hard to give career choice advice to others because each person is unique and you have to look at, you know, what do you really want, you know, out of your career? And I think that people need to be really clear about that. I mean, I was really clear from the beginning, as long as I can remember, that it was about the work. I wanted to be on a stage. It wasn't, I want to be a movie star. It wasn't, I want to make a lot of money. You know, and you know, those goals are fine if that's what you want, but theater, the odds are it's not going to get you there. So you have to be realistic about that and you know, and target what you want and figure out the best way you can think of to get there. And I help actors when I coach them on that, or playwrights even. Sometimes I work with playwrights who were writing a play about a life experience and had no experience writing a play. So I kind of help them to shape it. I never get involved with the content of somebody else's play. That's their decision, although I know that a lot of particularly playwriting teachers in universities often do that, and I wish they wouldn't, except sometimes it gives me new clients for coaching because they, I don't know what to do, you know, I want to get my master's and she keeps changing my play and tell me I need to rewrite this and rewrite that, you know, and add a scene about this and add a new character, and I do the best I can, but sometimes they have to just switch to something else. I mean, it's not going to happen, and it's unfortunate, you know. I mean, my job as a coach or teacher is to help that person to shape what they already want to say, whether it's in a role or, you know, in a script. You know, what do you want to say? How can you best say it? And it's all, again, it's all about techniques and skills, and that's what I can give them, is what's been given to me, you know, which is not, I think you should write about. I mean, I don't have to relate to what they're writing about, but a lot of teachers do that. You know, well, you should change it. You should put in some magic realism there. Why? It's not, you know, that, and newcomers, they need to find that confidence, whatever it takes to find it, and to trust. It's back, basically a trust issue. They have to trust themselves, to trust their instincts. No matter what somebody else says, if it does not resonate with you, get rid of it and go on to somebody else that you feel comfortable with, who sees what you want to do and helps you to do it, not helps you to change it. And it's that trust. And when I coach actors, particularly for auditions, the main thing is to get them to trust themselves. Because if they're bright, and almost every actor is, right, then there's no reason to not trust their instincts. So it's just for me to get them to stop judging themselves and just go with what their instincts are and to trust those instincts, which usually are very, very good and clear and sharp.
That's good advice.
Yeah, what, like 10, 15 minutes?
So over the years, do you feel like you have seen the industry change in any significant ways? And if so, do you feel like they've been positive or negative?
Yes to all of that. It really depends on what part of the industry you're talking about. Film has certainly changed, at least in the filmmaking, that there's been a lot of anti-union pressure over the years, and there was a big gap in my working in films, and I noticed when I went back to it, and I went back as an extra doing background, I noticed the contract had deteriorated tremendously. And that's unfortunate. And I don't blame the union. I blame all that, you know, political pressure and governmental pressure. But I sure wish that it would go back. You know, I mean, that we could restore some of what we had. I don't see that happening in the near future, considering, you know, our political situation these days. But so that's one way it's changed, and not for the better. And I think with all of the new technology, best films are still the ones that tell a good story. And that's my prejudice as a writer and also as an actor. You know, I mean, I'm not against these big epics. They're fun. But I also don't want us to ever lose the other films that don't rely on that, that actually focus on human beings. As my late friend Paula, who was an actress from England, used to say, acting is human beings in a situation going through an experience. And to me, that summarizes it. And you don't always see that on screen in these epics, but, you know, they're fine for what they are. But I don't want them to ever be the only option. So when there are smaller films, or we call them smaller, I don't think of them as smaller. I think of them as more intimate, more humanistic in a way. And, you know, those are the ones I prefer. Although I was in the third row in an IMAX theater watching Dunkirk, and I felt like I was an extra on the beach. But it was an amazing movie. And yet, in that movie, you learn very little about the individual characters. It was a real epic. But I enjoyed it immensely. But I don't want it to ever be the only kind of storytelling on screen. As far as theater, again, you know, the technology has changed, not as much as in film, but there are other options for multimedia forms of plays, of productions, which can be exciting. I've done a little bit of it, although I've had constraints with, you know, with budgets. But, you know, I've done some of it. And one of the things we did with one of my musicals, which actually was the same year somebody did that on Broadway, and people thought that, oh, that's where I got the idea when we had been working on it for a year, was we cast actors who played musical instruments. And when they weren't in the scene, they accompanied the songs. And it worked out beautifully. The difference was when we recorded the studio album, and the composer, who's Alison Tartaglia, who's a wonderful, wonderful composer, who I think, if she hasn't won it, she's been nominated for Emmys, I know, for scoring films and TV shows. Anyway, she called me up and she said, I'm listening to these tracks, and I've got to get some people in here, professional musicians, to override some of these tracks, because what works in a live production, you can excuse some of the pitchiness or whatever she calls it, you know, because you're seeing the whole picture, the performance, the set, everything. But when all you hear is the audio and you're a perfectionist like Allison is, it's not acceptable, and I love her for that. And so we've ended up with some, with a couple of excellent, excellent original cast albums for the musicals that we've done. So, you know, those are the main changes, but the basics haven't changed. You know, you still need human beings in a situation going through an experience, or it's not theater. It's storytelling, which is different. It's narration, which is different. And I tell people, yes, you have to have a story in a play, but it's not storytelling. It's recreating an experience or creating an experience. So.
So you seem to be very involved still in the work and in the community. I have encountered older actors who feel like they've kind of fallen off or are not as involved as they would like to be. Mm-hmm. For lack of a better word, mm-hmm. advice for an actor who's aging or a playwright who's aging and wants to get their work out there or, you know, just be involved in the community.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's hard for me to give general advice, you know. For myself, I created a way, so that's not an issue. I have a venue in New York for my plays. I can write parts for myself, and I have a place to do them, you know. And I have those two plays, which I occasionally do when invited, or if I see an opportunity, I'll recommend it, and it gets accepted. And again, I think it's different for people whose whole careers have been in commercial theater and who have only been actors, let's say. When they start, quote, aging out, which I find horrendous, I don't know what their options are, you know, other than to, you know, try to create work for themselves. But I don't know how they could do that and have a venue, except that they can maybe contact some of the producers of the playwrights that they've done work for in the past and ask them, can I create a project with you or for you? That's the only thing I can think of. Now, I once, in one of my plays, had a woman, cast this woman, who was lovely at the audition, and then we got into rehearsals, and she could not remember her lines and did not want to face that. So it affected her attitude, particularly towards me and my, you know, and the other people, not the other actors. She was always nice to them. There was one performance where she jumped a whole scene. Anyway, it was so difficult. And she gave me such a hard time that it got to the point where I just said to the assistant director, you talk to her from now on because I can't. And it was a shame. I mean, my mother had Alzheimer's. I know what dementia does to somebody. And I know that in the early stages it must be terrifying. But and maybe it was that I was not savvy enough to handle it better. I don't know. But it should never have come to that, you know. And she continues to give good auditions and get work, and I understand there are problems with every production. And it's really unfortunate because she's had a career that should have stood for something, and now it's being, you know, I don't want to say tainted, but, you know, influenced by what's going on later and the behavior issues, which come from beginnings of dementia. I mean, I'm not, my siblings are social workers, I'm not. I only know from my experience with my mother what it was like for her when she was still aware of it and how frightening it was and how it made her often very angry, and she would take it out only on somebody she trusted. Like my older sister, who was her primary caregiver, got the brunt of it, you know, but she would never do it to anybody else. It was too scary. You know, so for older actors, I don't know what to tell them, you know, if that's an issue. It's not always an issue. I've worked with people, you know, in their 80s, and that's not an issue. They can remember every single thing, you know, including recently, which I understand dementia, that's what goes first, but, you know, learn their lines and everything. But I would hope that when people get to that point that they're able to reach out for help, first of all, and learn how to cope with it better. But denial's a big part of it, and it's a shame, but it is an issue with older actors in particular who have to memorize lines and who are no longer able to. So I don't know what the answer is. I'm very fortunate. I'm not in that situation, but I understand it if I were. As far as playwrights, I don't think age is an issue. You either find your venues or you don't, or you find the people that you will work with you or want to produce your work, and that is a long term thing to pursue. And I can only advise based on my own experience, but each person's experience is different. I mean, I found myself a theater that I got hooked in with, and I'm very fortunate as a playwright in New York City to have a venue for my new work every single year. I know how fortunate I am, and I'm very, very grateful to Crystal Field and Theater for the New City. I did want to mention, when you're talking about aging, there was somebody who was a mentor as well, was Barbara Barandas. And she had a theater foundation, and I received their Torch of Hope Award. The other playwrights that had received it before me were Terrence McNally, August Wilson, A.R. Gurney, I mean, all these, and I was like, okay, I'll take it. But Barbara was in her 90s. She had had four very successful careers in film. She was in movies with Garbo and Jean Harlow and, you know, those people, and left when she got married because she said that she made 27 movies and in 25 of them they cast her as a prostitute. So she didn't want to be typecast. So then she went to UCLA and became an interior decorator and then a fashion designer. And then she came back to New York, to New York Theater, where she had started. She started on Broadway. That was her first theater job. She ran for 2 years. Anyway, so she started this foundation, and she was amazing. You know, her memory was intact, and her willpower was incredible. She came to see reading of my play. It was bitter cold. It was snowing. I mean, it was like in the teens, and I wouldn't have been there if it wasn't my play. And she showed up, you know, at around 90 years old. So she was very influential, not just, you know, for getting this award, but as an example of somebody who could transition from one thing to the next and back again and be successful in all of it. And, you know, her apartment, originally in Park Avenue, then on 57th Street, you know, her dining room table, her mahogany table, was about the size of my studio apartment. But she earned every penny. You know, she was the daughter of immigrants. She was raised upstairs from their grocery store. Everything she did, she earned herself. So what an example to see. And she died in her 90s. And from what I understand from a relative, she needed surgery. And she said, I had enough. I don't want to be operated on. And that was it. But her vanity knew no end. But so did her compassion. She would make dinner for me. She'd invite me over. And she would always ask, how's your family? How's your mother doing? You know. And she meant it. You know. And then, you know, but she, like I'm doing now, can talk and talk and talk about herself. About her life story. About her journey back to Russia when she was an infant. And then her being trapped with her parents there and then two more children, and not very much like my father's situation. They could not get back to the U.S. And she was a citizen. She was born here. And it took them, you know, same thing, paying smugglers and all of that to be able to get back here. So, you know, we had that in common. But she, what an example she was, you know, and generous. I mean, she started this foundation. She would sponsored play readings that were free and, you know, things like that. And she's a good example for those of us who have an opportunity to share or to advise or to assist to do it. Because we also learn from that, and there's pleasure in that as well.
So to wrap up a little bit, is there anything else that you want people to know about you or your career or about the industry in general?
That's a big question.
It is. I'm sorry for that.
No. I mean, I've covered a lot in this hour.
I could give you two sentences. Are there two sentences or two things going forward?
Okay. Well, I would tell people to follow your dream. Don't let people tell you it's a bad dream. It's an unreachable dream. It's unrealistic. You know, make sure you have something to back it up. No, do what feels right to you, and don't let go unless you're ready to. Don't do it for somebody else. That's the main thing I would tell other people. And the reason I can tell other people is I often have to tell myself and remind myself of that same thing. You know, that am I straying from way back as a child what I knew I wanted to do with my life? Am I still there? And sometimes I have to remind myself, no, don't go there. That's not what you wanted to do. Come back. And so it's something I try to live by constantly and remind myself. But all in all, I can answer that question that my high school friend asked, you know, did you ever get to do what you wanted to do with your life? And it may not be the way I thought it would be, but yes, I got to do what I wanted to do with my life, which is devote my life to working in theater, and that's what I've been doing. And I consider myself successful because I get to see my work on stage, you know, whether it's being on stage myself or putting my plays on stage. I get to do that, and I know that's a gift, and I never take it for granted.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.